You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
This episode of the Sinister Podcast is brought to you by LT Wright Knives. LT Wright Knives are handcrafted in Ohio with the finest locally sourced materials. They build everything from everyday carry to bushcraft and even overland specific. Everything that LTWK builds comes with a lifetime guarantee and is designed from the ground up to be a solid working knife. Find out more online at centersteer.com/LTWK. The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 37 for April 2016. This is our third year anniversary show, and we are part of the 4x4 Radio Network. And I invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Also, visit our website, centersteer.com, that's C-E-N-T-R-E for you American listeners, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's shows. And I want to thank everybody for your comments, your follows, your likes on Facebook, Twitter, and email. In particular, I'll shout out to Chip for posting about the Range Rover Bowler he posted on the Facebook page, and to Vasily for posting about his D90 here in North America. We're going to try to get him on the show soon to tell us his story. We talked privately with Vasily, and he gave me a story, and I think it's kind of interesting, so we're going to try to get him on the show. Vasily, if you're listening, which I assume you are, give me a shout out. We'll get you on the show. I'm your host, John Costage. Joining me here from Western Pennsylvania on this wonderful spring day. It's, about 80, 70 degrees or so Fahrenheit here in Western PA? It's
68.
It's 68. I was close.
Yeah, close.
It's
above freezing. You're close.
We did have a frost warning last night.
Yeah, we did.
And that's, of course, Harold, as everybody probably knows his voice by now. Say hello, Harold.
Hello, Harold.
And joining us all the way from the Green Mountain State, how's the temperature and the weather there?
It's pretty good up here in Vermont, around 45 today, but it was actually 70 on Friday, so can't complain about that.
So the snow is starting to melt off?
This winter, we didn't have any snow, basically.
It's a shame. It's a shame. And that's Morgan, actually, by the way, for those who don't know his voice yet.
Thank you.
And our contributor, Dave, is actually out doing fun and enjoyment. He's at the Robesonia Trials in central Pennsylvania, and so we're hoping to hear about that trials on the next podcast.
He's generating show content for next time.
He is. And he posted on his Facebook page that one of the trial names is actually named after him.
Yeah, Dave Sees Window Rubbish.
You may recall he blew out his back window, I think last year or the year before.
And scattered the contents of his truck out the hole left by a shattering window.
Too funny. Our guest this month is going to be Graham and Louisa Bell. They are friends of the show, as you probably know. They are traveling the world, currently in Baja, Mexico, and they are going to have a new book coming out, and they're going to talk about the Kickstarter they have going on for that and tell us about the new book and what's going on with them and what their plans are.
I'm not sure I'd call them friends of the podcast. I think they're more like recurring characters.
Yeah, Graham is a character. All right. Before we get to our guest, we are going to talk about the news. And as we like to discuss Jag Land Rover sales out of Land Rover Owners International, had Land Rover Owner International magazine had an interesting headline that JLR is selling a car every 2 minutes. So Jag Land Rover as a company sold 25,127 vehicles in March. That's up 16% from March of 2015, their best ever performance for the month. That kind of boils down to what I said, they're selling a car every 2 minutes in the UK, and Land Rover sold 19,400 vehicles in March. That's up 9%. So doing very, very well with the Range Rover Evoque and the Disco Sport leading the charge.
As usual.
Yes, they are. And things are going well for JLR. And here in North America, there was an industry publication called Automotive News. Talked to Michael Levitin, who is chairman of the Jag Land Rover Retailer Cabinet, which looks like to be a grouping of dealers throughout North America. And they did a kind of a question and answer for him. And I'll let, there's, of course, a link in the show notes if you want to read more detail about it. They talk about the new Jag coming out with the Crucial XE sedan, how it, if it's a, and it's how it fits into things, talking about diesels and how that affects things. Which, actually, there was an interesting comment about in the diesel area, because they asked him about the fuel prices in the United States have dropped significantly in the last year or so, down from $5 a gallon to, like, what are we, about $2.50 now a gallon, at least in Pennsylvania. And they wanted to know if that helped sales, you know, Range Rover sales in particular, and his his response was, lower fuel prices? Not really. It wasn't on people's list when it was near $5 a gallon.
If you can afford a Range Rover, the cost of the fuel isn't really the consideration.
The added value for us in diesel is not only the added fuel economy, but the range. How many times they have to fill up their car. So getting 400 or 500 miles on a tank is the added value for our customers today, not lower fuel prices.
Not to mention the coolness factor.
Indeed. Well, for us, I mean, we're the diesel fans, right?
Well, of course.
I don't think the
that's what matters.
Yes, but I don't think the average Range Rover fan doesn't really care about that.
Well, they should.
Indeed, they should. Speaking of things that we like and care about, so they asked a pointed question about two questions about the Defender. I will read you those questions and answers now. Have U.S. Land Rover dealers been consulted on what features need to be in the next version of the Defender? And is that vehicle confirmed for the U.S.? His response, quote, no comment on that, unquote.
In other words, no.
Next question. Do Land Rover dealers want the new Defender? His response. We would love it, but it really depends on what the product will be and if it makes economic sense. New product is always welcomed by any retailer, unquote.
Well, we had a guest on a few episodes ago, and they were talking about the concept of selling widgets, and this just goes to that. You know, the dealers don't really care what it is as long as they can sell it.
For some reason, I flashed on Mad Men, because remember they talked about selling the new Jag, the XKE. I don't know why I flashed on that, but that was just, well, basically, it was just a car, and they were happy to sell a car.
You got a flash on something, that's a good one.
We got a bunch of news on new vehicles coming out. First, some reviews here in North America. Two reviews on the 2016 Range Rover Sport TD6. Not surprising, both Autoblog and Roadshow, which is a CNET publication, they love the vehicle. Of course, it's quite pricey. And there's a $2,000 premium for the diesel engine.
Which is cheap, actually. A lot of manufacturers charge 8 to 10 for the diesel upgrade.
I'll give you the Roadshow here did a nice little good, bad, and bottom line. Range Rover's new diesel engine allows incredible range and torque for a reasonable $2,000 premium. While its standard air suspension system yields a comfortable ride and competent handling, the interior is beautifully trimmed. Bad, the slow infotainment interface response to input, lack of CarPlay and Android Auto compatibility, and false alarms from its pre-collision warning system signal the need for some tech improvements. There's also slightly more diesel clatter from the engine than some competitors under light throttle. Bottom line, Land Rover's big luxury SUV icon is the best with its TD6 diesel engine under the hood.
So, in other words, all of the electronic features remind you that this is a British vehicle.
Indeed. Indeed. Moving along, and of course, I have links to those both of those articles if you want to read the reviews in particular. But it sounds like really, really cool vehicles. If you are one of our listeners and you have to buy one, we'd love to get you on the show after you've driven it for 1,000 miles or so. And
you need to bring it here.
Oh yes, better yet, that's true. Drive it.
We'll give you live time on the show.
Yes, drive it to podcast headquarters, and we'll have you on the show, and you can tell us all about it. And we could drive around in it.
Our podcast staff will give it a thorough testing.
Yes, we will. Flog it going down. Oh, I'm sorry.
We could absolutely record the episode from within
the confines of the Range Rover, and it's supposed to be so quiet that it's probably better than the actual podcast studio.
Well, we will be able to evaluate whether or not there is too much diesel clatter at full throttle.
We'll record it. I'll get the recording equipment out. JLR readies the Ingenium Straight 6 for launch in 2017. So, JLR has come up with this new engine called Ingenium, and currently it's a 4-cylinder, but they're going to push it into a 6-cylinder and push it out throughout the range of vehicles.
Why not? That formula's worked well for Cummins.
The new six-cylinder, due in late 17, is a direct-injection turbocharged 3-liter unit, which will be offered in petrol and diesel form. Eventually, the power output is going to be staggered in three stages for executive and express iterations, which brings the total to six variations, according to car magazine sources. So, new engine coming.
Cool.
Nice. And nice to see that it's petrol and diesel.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a throwback, isn't it?
For sure.
Hopefully those diesels continue to make it to the U.S. now, too.
Well, it sounds like the Ingenium is going to be more likely to come to the U.S., so.
Yeah.
The interesting thing that's running through my mind about right now is that if the engine is the same platform and it's available in both petrol and diesel versions, what's the possibility of doing a retrofit down the road?
Ooh.
Ooh.
In case they, in their infinite wisdom or lack thereof, choose not to offer a diesel version, how many parts would you have to bring in and swap over?
Do we have to wait 25 years, though?
Well, legally.
Of course, we do not recommend anybody break laws of your respective nation. Although I have been considering, you know, everybody probably knows, my daily driver is a Jetta TDI, which is subject to the problems here in the U.S. That the Volkswagen has gone through. And so, you know, there's discussion that they might buy back the vehicle and give you some money extra towards it. And I thought, well, the only thing I would consider if I had to do that is maybe get a diesel Land Rover. But none of the ones that I would be interested in are available at the moment.
Something tells me the bonus compensation they give you will not be sufficient.
I know. It's wishful thinking. Come on.
Yeah, but we will all have that option, as I understand it. I think the deal was struck just a couple days ago, and there will be options to either sell your vehicle back to them or have them fix it.
Right. That's the thinking. And it has to be approved. Apparently, it went to the attorney, to the judge or whomever's adjudicating that, and they're now reviewing it. They have, like, I think, a month to get back.
Right.
And
EPA has to approve the fix, and then once that's done, then I think the deal is pretty much in.
Well, I think that's the problem from what I've been reading, which we have no links to show notes for this one because I didn't keep these stories. But from what I've been reading is they don't know what the fix is even going to be. They still have not figured that out.
Right.
Which is... yeah, kind of interesting. I don't know. I thought, well, why don't you just maybe, you know, if they had to, maybe buy the vehicles back and put them into another market, which has less of an issue. Could they do that?
Yeah, no, they wouldn't do that.
Okay.
Yeah. They're going to treat this like any other vehicle that's been outside of their control, like a flood vehicle, whatever. They're going to buy them. They're going to squash them.
Ah, okay. Makes sense. Yeah. Interesting.
Sad.
It is. Indeed. I still love driving that thing, man. It is a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Oh, anyways, so yeah, if the Disco Sport was available, I think as a diesel, I would I'd consider that. But that's just because it would be interesting.
That may be happening.
It could be, and maybe by the time all this goes down, it might be the fact, because that would be in the fall theoretically, and you know, if I could hold out till then, it might happen. Anyway,
you can drive the 109 for the summer, right?
The 109 is doing well, not having any major issues that I'm aware of that I've noticed, and it did some important work this past weekend, as a matter of fact.
I would say just because you're not aware doesn't mean they're not happening.
That's true. It is a Series 3. I picked up two picnic benches, picnic tables from local place. Put them in the back. They were flat packed. Back of the 109 fit perfectly in the back. Transformed to the brewery. Boom. We built. We now have picnic benches at the brewery.
I noticed your 109 is now looking like a troop carrier.
Yes. Yes, and it has a
big bench seats in the back. Right.
That's right. Yeah. There's that was another bench I bought. And I wanted to see if it didn't really fit at the brewery. So. Yeah, I need your help getting that out of the truck when the podcast's over, by the way.
Chain the one end to a tree and go for a drive. It'll come out the back, I guarantee it.
More on new vehicles. We should continue with the podcast. Newer Land Rovers are being spotted on the roads in the UK and in Europe. Apparently the new Disco 5, or LF4 as we call it here in the US, or Hopefully they're going to call it the Disco 5 again here in the U.S., but that's been spotted. There is some discussion, though.
Is this one also wearing these form of raccoons paint job?
Yes, this one's not as interesting as the one you normally like. This is more splotchy.
Not so much squares. All the raccoon eyes.
Yes, correct. I think the one that's in Nuremberg Ring, I think that one you might like better.
I might have to get somebody that does wraps to do that one for me. I like that one.
Here's one, Harold. This was talking about the Disco 5 possibly getting an SVO-tuned vehicle for off-road trim called the SVX. And
I like that sound already.
There you go.
It's hard to ruin anything with special vehicle ops.
Indeed, indeed. And they just like throwing letters at the end of these things, don't they?
Well, it makes it faster.
More letters makes it faster.
Damn straight.
Do we have a show name now? So the Disco 5, this article talked about how the special vehicle operations may be extended to the entire range of Land Rover and all vehicles.
Sure, why not?
And in all stages, because usually it just seems like they're oriented towards the premium side, but they may be getting into kind of the off-road side too.
So what exactly is the non-premium side of Land Rover?
Good question.
The stuff they've stopped making. Ooh, Defender.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, you're right. Because the
and even that sort of premium in a way too. But
Does a Defender not fetch a premium price?
Well, it does for what it is.
Here in the U.S., it does.
Well, and the new Defenders, I heard, is likely to be positioned between the Disco and the Range Rover, so it's going to be premium as well. You pay extra to get less function.
Well, even if it's positioned below the Disco, I think it's still going to be a premium vehicle. I mean,
right.
The whole brand is now premium.
Right. I just find it funny that you take dial the luxury out of something to make it a utility and then raise the price.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, isn't that the whole car industry itself? I mean,
that reminds me of those supercar Lambos and Ferraris. They put the racing version. They take all the seats out and everything else and then double the price.
Right. Oh, I see. Yeah, right, right. Well, I was thinking, though, if you look, especially in America here, you look at the pickup trucks, and they're all these super high-end vehicles. They're now premium editions. You know, there's very few that you can get stripped
down. Yeah, but they
add
a lot of luxury gadgets for that when they raise the price. It's not like they take stuff out and then raise the price.
I would take it from a different tack. I think that, especially for those pickups, there's not a lot that you can find that are actually on the utility side that are truly utility at a cheaper price. I think what they do is they have just a couple of those as kind of loss leaders to get you in the door, but then they have all these additional, the bulk of them that they sell, have all these
they're upselling.
And they're upselling, and then they have, so there's very few you can get. You have to get one almost that's the four-door, it's the King Cab, and it's got all the bells and whistles on it.
That is what most people want. But you can still get the work trucks. They are available.
It's tough. That's
but it's not like you pay extra for the work truck is where I'm going
with this. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, yeah. I was talking more that they were
You come in for the real fancy one, the leather seats and everything, and then they upsell you the one with the vinyl seats and
bare metal in the back.
And roll-up windows and then tell you it's $10,000 extra.
True. Yeah, they don't do that, but they certainly have gone more premium. And sounds like we've all agreed, Land Rover has become kind of all premium too. There's the Disco at the Nuremberg Ring, Harold. You can take a look at that picture. Is that a little better for you? Do you like that livery there? That's a little more stripey.
It's kind of paisley-like.
It is kind of paisley, yes. So
we need to have a Prince edition in purple.
That'd be cool. I bet you there was one. That'd be cool. That would be so cool.
Again, there's an opportunity for a wrap shop.
That's right. But this one, this Disco 5 was at the Nuremberg Ring, and I think we've heard this before, but it's in print again that Land Rover has a permanent test facility near the track, and they've developed everything from the Evoque to the Range Rover Sport there. So now the Disco 5 is at the ring getting tested.
In the process of being ruined, according to James May.
the Range Rover Sport SVR facelift is coming with a power boost. So this is a 2017 model is coming, and again, SVO. Is SVR an SVO SVO model, or is SVR stand on its own? I'm getting all confused with all the letters.
Well,
now.
SVO would be the Special Vehicle Operations. That's the division, the office that makes all of the.
Do they make the SVR?
Well, that would be a model produced by them, I would think. But
as I read this, I don't see SVO mentioned here, so maybe it's just a normal SVR is a normal non-SVO.
So what would the SVO version of that be?
Let's see, SVX?
SV squared R?
Speaking of Range Rovers, there looks like the Range Rover Sport may, because there's rumor that there may be a coupe version. So this would be just a, you know, almost like a bigger Evoque, because the Evoque has a coupe version. This would be a larger one. This might compete with the BMW X6 or the X4, and it's supposed to share the Jag F-Pace chassis.
Well, it's some good coming out of the F-Pace development.
Indeed.
It's kind of a nice throwback, too, because the first Range Rovers were two doors.
They were. That's right.
Well, it's true.
Or three doors, or coupes, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I'm sure stamped on the VIN it was counted as three-door, but you know.
Indeed, that's, yeah, the very first Range Rovers. How long were they? It took them a couple years before they had a proper four-door, right? Because they were first several years.
I think it was like 11 years.
I was going to say 10, so yeah.
That long? Okay, I didn't think it was that
long.
We
may get into that later in the show.
I think we might.
We anticipate. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, our new Heritage segment is coming up, and we can tease that out. We're going to start talking about Range Rovers.
Consider yourself teased.
A Land Rover put out a press release that said that they are demonstrating autonomous vehicle capability in Amsterdam. And yeah, it's out there.
Who's
think
not testing autonomous vehicles these days?
Well, you should be. If you're not, you should be.
Amsterdam is quite the interesting place to be testing them.
Well, this is because this is in support of the EU's plans for standardization and harmonization of autonomous vehicle technology. Land Rover's demonstrated a range of research autonomous vehicle technologies in Amsterdam. So apparently there was a meeting of the transport and environment ministers from the EU member states. I think that's why they were in Amsterdam.
Centrally located in the EU.
Speaking of design, Jerry McGovern, Land Rover's chief designer, is to receive an honorary doctorate from Coventry University, of which he attended a school when he was a student.
I got nothing nice to say, so I'm going to just not.
We'll move on. Okay. JLR is renaming their Heritage Division to JLR or Jag Land Rover Classic. So you may have heard.
Yes. So I'm just surprised that the Heritage Division lasted such a short period of time.
I think they heard about our Heritage segment and they didn't want to compete, right?
They were worried we were going to hit them with a cease and desist.
Exactly.
I'm just wondering if this is going to cause confusion between Land Rover Classic and Range Rover Classic.
Well, so now you can get a Range Rover Classic Classic? How does that work?
Well, hang on.
Land Rover Classic, Range Rover Classic. People are already confused enough between Land Rover and Range Rover.
Exactly my point.
Yeah, don't get me started on that one. Well, but this is just the Land Rover JLR Classic is just a kind of a division of people.
Right.
And they are going to, and they've already started to build these 25 new Series 1 Rovers in the factory itself, and that's what this is all about.
Right.
So I guess once they start rebuilding Range Rover Classics, I mean, maybe then there'll be some confusion.
Well, just once that name starts hitting the news, people get confused between, there's that new Range Rover Classic division.
Yeah, people are going to.
Making those Series 1 Range Rovers.
Let me see. So it would be the Jaguar Land Rover Classic Range Rover Classic, right?
Okay. You tell me.
We can put more letters after it. How's that? Make it easier for you.
To be fair, it was only the Range Rover Classic in the U.S., but, you know.
Was that actually a name?
For a very short period of time.
Was that actually a name here?
It's never been an official name, but everybody uses it.
We'll get to that, too.
Okay.
It was.
Oh, we'll learn. We'll learn something. That'd be very cool.
All right.
Excellent. Excellent. So this JLR Classic, you know, they had taken 25 Series 1s, ran them through the factory again, and are now selling them. They were stripped completely down to bare metal, a bolt and nut rebuild. You can buy them for 60,000 to 80,000 pounds.
Which is a fair price, given what's involved in doing a restoration.
Indeed.
Plus, this gives you the added value of it actually being restored at its original factory.
And they would be they receive a factory warranty,
like full bumper to
bumper to end.
rear cross member,
side to side. Yeah, there we go. And there, there may be a name called Reborn, maybe attached to them. So,
oh dear,
yeah. But there you go.
Could do without that part of it.
Yeah. A little interesting side note to the Reborn program. This comes on the announcement. This is mainly for Harold because he's a Jag fan. This comes on the heels of Jaguar's XKSS continuation series. Jag will assemble 9 XKSS sport cars, which remained unproduced after fire broke out at the Browns Lane factory in February of 1957.
Always a cool thing.
Yeah. What is the XKXS? That's the... I'm going to say swoopy one, but they're all swoopy, aren't they?
Well, this one was extra swoopy. It makes the E-Type look like a shoebox.
Ah, cool.
It's extra sexy, hence the 2 S's on the end.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Nice.
2 S's for extra sexy.
Yep.
Gotcha.
The interesting thing about this whole Series 1 rebirth thing is, you know, Land Rover had said that they were going to start reproducing some of the parts. Clearly, that had to happen for them to actually be able to rebuild all of these Series 1 Land Rovers. So, you know, genuine parts are always extremely expensive, but it'll be interesting to see how many make it to the market.
Because they didn't want to just scour the internet to find out who still had parts. They just made them.
It's probably cheaper.
It's a little easier.
It's not like they had a website they could go to and search for the parts.
Really, you know, if only there was this place.
There's only, yeah, the internet would be good for a location where I could type in what I need, bulkhead, you know. It would
be pretty hilarious, actually, if JLR was hitting up series parts looking for stuff.
I wouldn't be surprised if they had done some of the stuff they've done, because they might have had to. You have a good resource there, Morgan.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Do we think we might get bulkheads out of this, speaking of which? Because isn't that the one? Have you heard anything on that?
You know, I haven't.
Okay.
Yeah, the interesting
I have a
thing
feeling
is...
that there are enough third parties reproducing and rebuilding bulkheads, especially galvanized bulkheads, that it's probably not something that they need to jump right into.
It's probably not a high priority, but on the other hand, there's a big difference between a rebuilt bulkhead and a brand spanking new one.
Yeah,
and I don't think anybody's doing that for Series 1, are they?
What's that?
I don't think anybody's doing that for the Series 1, are they?
No, I don't think so.
Because, I mean, that's kind of their focus right now, and I think that really the biggest boon to the enthusiast right now is what they're doing with Series 1 parts.
Absolutely.
Is that going to show up on your seriesparts.com? Is that kind of stuff, or are you just going to stay with kind of used parts?
Oh, no. I mean, I link to parts suppliers, so it really depends on when they start making it to market.
Okay.
Or if they sort of keep them all in-house.
I assume you're paying attention to that.
As best I can, yeah.
So if they're selling them, you're listing it.
Or whoever they're, you know, anybody who's selling genuine parts.
Got it.
Okay. So check out seriesparts.com if you have not already visited that site. It's Morgan runs it for your series and Defender parts needs throughout the planet. Correct?
That's correct.
There we go.
We need to get a banner ad going across the Center Steer website.
Yeah, we could talk about that. Yeah, you know.
Negotiate some per-click fees.
That's right. I sent him a microphone, so I considered that some payment for something already. How's that? Yes, there you go. Yes. No one but us can see that you've just held up the microphone. So moving along in the news, that's just an interesting story. And if you want to read the backstory, there's a link to it. But CNN had a Defender that was armored up, and they used it for a number of years in various conflicts, especially in the Middle East and in Europe. And it's now being rebuilt. I call it the pizza truck. I guess when it was first produced, it had this big box in the back, and then it was slower than normal.
And then, how would you know?
Well, they tell one story in here. They were, I think, in Bosnia, and they had struggled to keep up, and the convoy, the military convoy in front of them stopped to let them catch up. And they, when they got up to them, they end up hitting the back of one of these vehicles, in the one of the military vehicles, because it, you know, didn't stop well, and the military vehicles thought they had...
Compared to what?
Military vehicle thought a mine had exploded underneath.
Oh, no.
It was like an IED or something. It was funny. So it's interesting. If you're, you want history of...
So you were driving at the time when this happened?
Most likely. It would have been interesting. But it's a long, neat little story on CNN. I'll, again, have a link to it. It's been used for a number of years, and it eventually has an interesting story, and it was used to...
Trying to figure out why getting pizza during a conflict like that is so important.
No, I just think it looked like a pizza truck. It wasn't a pizza truck. That was just what it... You can read the story. And then, but it's going to be rebuilt. And it will, and then it'll be on display at the British Heritage Motor Museum. So,
and it's looking in pretty rough shape right now, so it definitely needs a rebuild.
Oh yeah, it was. I think if I remember right, when I read the article, the people that originally did it are going to do it again, I think, and then give it to the museum.
Well, it's hard to find an armored vehicle that doesn't look in rough shape, because, you know, the first thing that happens is, you know, I can prove this thing's bulletproof.
That's true. Oh, I have to apologize. It's not going to the British Motor Museum. It is going to take into a more permanent home at the IWM American Air Museum in Duxford near Cambridge.
Cool.
So,
good use for it.
Yes, put it on display there. I guess it's the American Air Museum, which I thought that was in. I thought that was north of London. Maybe that's the 8th Armored. That's the 8th Air Force Wing. There's a museum there. At RAF Hendon. So, anywho. So, yeah, check that out. Next in some news is Jalopnik has been talking a lot about the Defenders having problems coming to the United States, and this is another example of that. And this is entitled "The Latest Fight Over Car Importing," specifically here in the U.S. A U.S. Army chief warrant officer has been trying to legally import his 1985 Land Rover Defender from when he was stationed in Germany. I remind you that in the U.S. you have to have it more than 25 years old, so that would be sufficient to bring it in. But apparently he's having difficulty getting it into the country.
Well, and the interesting issue here is that the reason why they're not letting it in is because it's been upgraded to a 200 TDI, which, according to the EPA, means it no longer is in original configuration. And that's the other side of the 25-year rule, is that it has to also be original. If you do an engine swap, you have to put the same type of engine it was manufactured in. Otherwise, they don't care how old it is, it's not coming in.
Oh.
And so this is really sort of a test of that law, and leading the charge is our good friend, the defender of defenders, Will Hedrick, and he's put together a rather interesting argument. And his argument is that by putting in the 200 TDI, you've made it technically identical to a 1990 Defender, which is old enough to qualify for the exemption. So it's going to perhaps set a precedent for the engine swapping world. But it's a real test of how you want to interpret the law. And this one is probably likely, if I read the story correctly, to go to trial, because the government's not willing to budge and settle on this one.
There, yeah.
Because it could be such a precedent that could open the floodgates for a lot of stuff. But I like his opinion that, you know, you haven't really deviated from the spec of something that would be legal by making it identical to a 1990, which is when the engine was first offered.
So a very lengthy article there. You feel free if you want to read all the details. It's in the story here, and we have a link again in the show notes. So my question comes back to original configuration. Is that everything? Like, if you swap out the radio, does that count?
This is only in terms of the EPA. This is the EPA's rule.
On the emission side of the...
Yeah,
of
it's the EPA's rule for what they will consider exempt.
Okay.
It's exempt if it... Actually, with EPA, it's 21 years. It's
right, that's a shorter time period.
Safety. 21 years for the EPA for the emissions, but okay, it's only eligible for that 21-year exemption if it has the original engine. If you put anything else in there, that engine must be certified in that vehicle for North America, or they will not let it in, regardless of how old it is.
Hmm.
So even if you put in an engine that's 20 years older than the vehicle, it's still not exempt.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They don't care about the age of the age of anything once you've changed.
You've changed the original configuration.
Correct.
And then, okay, gotcha. Hmm.
So Will is testing that rule, and perhaps there'll be a modification to the rule.
Which, right, another interesting...
I mean, he makes perfect sense. You could go out there and just as easily buy a 1990 Defender and bring it in, no questions asked. Why shouldn't this guy be allowed to have his 85 that he's owned personally when he was stationed in Europe?
Right. And it's still, and the engine that is in it is still perfectly fine.
And that was done for the purpose of just keeping it running. That's right. That's the option you have. And in right. Europe, that's fine. And kudos again to Will, who is taking up the cause and, as they say, fighting for our rights and our trucks. And he's still doing it.
Indeed. And he has just this past month liked our Facebook page. So a little shout out to Will. Hopefully you're listening, and you know you are have an open invitation to join us on the show.
Yeah, and just a little footnote: Will Hedrick also published an article in the latest LRO magazine, an article on decoding VINs.
Ooh, that could be interesting.
Yeah, since it's always complicated, and the Defenders were extra complicated because there were two different sets of VINs. The ones made, they don't quite follow the North American convention. There's a European convention for VIN decoding also, and so it gets extra complicated in a hurry.
Gotcha.
You can't just take a quick look at it on a rest of world Defender. You know, the North American guys can't just take a quick look and say, oh, no, this is wrong, because if they don't really know how it's put together.
Which he has had to explain in depth to the U.S. government already.
Right, and in fact, that was how he got a number of vehicles returned in that previous seizure, because the government was unaware that the six-digit sequential actually recycles after a number of years. So the 83s were coming up as 2000s.
Okay. That explains that.
Which was incorrect, and right. That was not entirely the government's fault. Land Rover, when they punched the numbers in, didn't punch all 17.
Oh, they just would
they
punch
just put in six, and six. That's what came up, and right. And now, I have a factory diagnostic machine for Jag, and when you, first thing you do when you hook the vehicle up, it says, give me the last six of the VIN, and you do that. And that's how the dealers and everything are used to doing it. But when I do that on my machine, it comes up with a number of options. Are you looking at this vehicle, or are you looking at this vehicle? Because it knows that they've recycled.
Oh.
Anyway, if you want to learn more about VINs, pick up the latest issue of LRO International.
There we go. And you can, I think they have an app now. You can get that electronically, too.
That could be.
Because I have it on my phone.
I've not checked it out yet, but yeah. I'm headed there sometime.
This is our, episode 37. So this is our third year.
36th anniversary.
36th anniversary. This is our third year of doing the podcast. We've been doing this.
36th month anniversary.
Every month for the past 3 years. Our very first guest was Graham Aldous, who produced several DVDs around Land Rover. And you may recall the first Overland is the one he did. That's how he got into Land Rovers, about the very first journey that was taken from, well, not the very first journey, but the journey.
The
that was
first Overland.
The first journey. Overland journey that was.
Hence the name.
And it was recorded and from the UK to
London to Singapore.
Singapore. I couldn't remember Singapore. So so that's Graham, and he has a newsletter. It's online, and he put out a new one. So it's at tfit.co.uk. You might want to just go check that out. He has an update on what he's been up to and what's going on in the items that he's been touching. So since he was our first guest, and he put out a new newsletter, number 35,
do we know which episode of our show he was on when he was our first guest? It wasn't the first episode. We didn't have guests for a little while.
It took 6 months maybe before.
It took us a while to get the hang of it just with ourselves before we'd trust it with a guest.
I should have done some research. I didn't do that research.
But this is his newsletter 35 and our episode 37. It's exactly. Too bad we weren't 2 months one way or the other.
Get him synced up. Yeah. No, unfortunately not. So go check it out. And there's a link to the show notes if you want to check out what he's been up to. And you should check out his videos. If you're even close to being a fan of Land Rover, they're really interesting to see. He did the Land Rover 65, and he was invited to to the events that were going on, and he did, you know, did the recording, so you can see all of the interesting Land Rover vehicles that had not been seen for a long time. You know, there was that forestry edition that was a one-off, and he did the firefighter vehicles that showed up and a lot of things. So it's a neat video to check out.
And the ice cream truck.
And the ice cream truck.
Ice cream truck.
Yeah. And he's also directly responsible for us getting Mike Bishop on the show, because I reached out to him, and he put us on to Mike Bishop and got Mike Bishop onto the podcast.
Which definitely makes him a friend of the podcast.
Yes, and more like indebted, I think. Yeah. So
I will tell you that I think one of my favorite parts of Graham's DVDs are in the bonus feature section, the comments that he has about stuff. And, you know, like in the first Overland, he tells the story of when he was a kid, and he had gotten the book through a monthly book club, and then he just happened to he'd seen the vehicles driving through and had discovered them, and that was his first exposure to Land Rovers, is he actually saw those gentlemen setting off on that Overland journey when he was a little kid.
His old tyke, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then he has another feature where he talks about the camera equipment and how incredibly difficult it must have been for them to make this production with using those old hand-cranked cameras.
Right. No sound, just a video. And and the BBC just kind of threw cameras at them and said go, and they did it themselves. And
That's pretty cool. It's a nice behind-the-scenes thing that he did, and I think he's done that on his other videos too, and it's fun.
Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast, show number 37. This is our third anniversary podcast special. And joining us, special guests, friends of the show, calling us once again. Apparently the only time they can join us is when they're in Mexico.
Or recurring characters.
It's Graham and Louisa Bell.
Recurring characters in our little theater of the internet here.
From Baja, Mexico, our friends, Graham and Louisa. How you guys doing?
Hey, John. How you doing, bro?
Wonderful.
Glad to hear you guys are doing well. Last time I think we talked to you, you guys had just come back from Alaska.
Yeah, that's right. Now, that's right.
What do you guys been up to since then? So you saw snow and kind of turned tail, if I can say that.
Headed back to Mexico.
And headed back to warm weather.
Yeah, you know, we're Africans after all. We heard there were rumors of snow, so we just turned around and ran as fast as we could, as fast as our Land Rover could carry us. And we heard in Mexico, in Baja, it's lovely all year round. And so we came and we found a ranch to come and house it here for a few months. And believe it or not, it snowed.
Twice.
How much? Yeah. How much? Just the dusting, or was it actual accumulation?
I'd say it's a couple of feet. That's how tall the snowman was when we were finished.
Oh, nice. That's snow.
So you learned how to drive then?
No, we didn't go anywhere. We just sat here petrified, drinking beer, staring at it, hoping it would go away.
It does eventually.
Yeah.
That was a good call. Drink beer, watch the snow melt.
Yeah.
There's a brewery here in the Pittsburgh area. They actually do have a beer called Snow Melt.
Oh, sweet.
Mm-hmm. Maybe when. So you've been sitting at this house sitting, and I know you've been writing a book or two or three. So what have you been doing while you're at the house sitting?
Well, it's a completely off the grid ranch. It's our nearest neighbor is about 6 miles away, and the road leading up to the house is up to the ranch is all 4x4 only. So we have to be pretty self-sufficient out here. We're chopping wood and fixing roads and growing vegetables and all that kind of stuff. We do have a lot of peace and quiet to sit and write and do a bunch of projects.
And you have a roof of more than just canvas too.
Exactly. Yes. The roof is made out of roofing material. So we've been writing a bunch of stuff. I even tried my hand at nonfiction, and then I realized I'm too stupid for nonfiction. Wait, fiction. You see, I just proved it. I got halfway in, and then I was like, how do you end this? There has to be a plot and stuff. Writing about my life, about our travels, is so much easier because I just have to use memory and try and throw some intellectual phrases in there now and then, and not to sound too stupid. But, yeah, so the sequel to We Will Be Free is in the works. I'm a couple thousand words into that. But the main project we're working on now is the second book, which is actually a Kickstarter campaign, which we're going to be launching tomorrow, if all goes well.
And what is the nature of this book that you're going to be launching? I don't have any details, and I don't think you've told us yet.
A secret, or closely guarded secret. Well,
we want an exclusive.
Yeah, no, this is an exclusive. First time out there.
You heard it here
basically,
first.
Basically, you know what? How many? We've been doing this for years now, and we've been all over the place and raising the family and living by our wits and going to pretty extraordinary places and living pretty rough. And, you know, the questions, we always get asked the same questions over and over. The number one question is, how do you afford it? But so we thought, you know, it's time that we answer some of those questions for people. When we started out, we made so many mistakes overlanding because we didn't really know what we were getting into. Yeah. And this book, what I'm trying to do is try and help people understand what it takes to overland and what you can do to be successful at it from the beginning. And it's whether you're riding a bicycle or whether you're driving a man truck. It kind of goes through the spectrum and it helps people understand things like how to choose the vehicle based on your style of travel and on your finances. And there's even a section that I'm very proud of, which is called How to Motivate Your Significant Other. yeah. And it's great. It uses neuro-linguistic programming, chocolate, sex, all kinds of stuff. There's like a whole, a guide to how to make your wife or husband love overlanding. You know, how many guys we met who said, I would be doing exactly what you're doing, but my wife hates camping. Right?
Right.
So now we've come up with a way that you can train your significant other so that they can love camping and therefore love overlanding, and therefore you can achieve your dreams. I mean, this is fantastic. This is groundbreaking stuff, John.
See, that's exclusive to the podcast. It's groundbreaking material. So is that your...
Yeah, so then we walk through that. Yeah. So it's basically the finances, how you can work and travel. The hacks for camping,
safety and security on the road,
dealing with border crossings, how to deal with bureaucracy.
There's recipes on there.
How to make a fire, how to make meat on a fire, how to keep your beer cold.
That's very critical.
Important that you
that's
do
critical.
Your mid-morning beer preparation, because you get to your camp at the end of the day, you don't want to have to then put your beer in the cooler box. That, no, you have to be. That's very important that you keep your beer cold. So stuff like that, you know, tons of useful information.
You know, stuff for the ladies in terms of a lot of women also ask me specific issues surrounding traveling with kids, and also you know how women react to overlanding and what they can do to make it easier. So we've got all of that in there. So it's a guide basically on how to overland, and even not overlanders and maybe long term, but how to make a camping trip a lot less difficult and use less packing space, you know, take less is more, right? So
yeah, there's gear reviews, stuff that we use, that we've used, stuff that's indispensable, stuff that you think is indispensable but you're going to land up just throwing on a pile somewhere. So yeah, really at the end of the day, the book's going to be about $40 on the Kickstarter campaign, but it's going to save you thousands at the end of the day if you follow that advice.
So
we're pretty excited about it.
What's the one thing that you took with you that you threw away or no longer needed that you thought that you were going to, you know, that was important? It turned out it wasn't.
Was there only one?
Well, let's go for one or two.
There were boxes of things.
When we began the trip, we did a small trip up the coast. In South Africa, and we left one box at my mother's.
A large box.
A very large box. And then we subsequently, I think, we pulled probably 4 to 5 boxes.
We actually landed up doing it in the beginning. We were doing it once every couple of months, where we landed up just giving shit away to the locals. In Dar es Salaam, for instance, I gave away a huge pile of stuff. Things that I thought that I absolutely had to have, but at the end of the day, you know, I mean, like gumboots. Gumboots, you think they're a great idea. Mm. But unless you're going to be going to places where you need gumboots, where it's going to be snowing and muddy and that all the time, if you're going on a trip and you think, I might need gum boots. You know what? Leave them. Just get dirty feet. Things like that. What else have we had? Weird contraptions. Walk into any REI and go through the aisles and look at all that crap that you think, God, that's a good idea. I really need that. I need a spork, right? Or I need a frisbee that I can use as a plate. Or I need this or that and the other. And you're going to walk out. You're going to spend thousands at REI. You're going to walk out. You're going to go on your overland trip. You're going to get around all of this crap just to get at your six-pack every single day. And eventually you realize, I haven't used this. And this is one of the advice we give. If you're not using it, you haven't used it in a month, chuck it. Get rid of it. Because it's not essential. It's not something you're going to use it.
I guess we won't be getting sponsorship from REI this month.
Well, no, I don't think so. But you know what? This is the same, at the same, in the same breath. There are very good products that you can find there that you are going to use. It's so seductive. I know the feeling. We wasted thousands. The equivalent in South Africa is called Cape Union Mart. And they're like your REI. And we used to walk in there and walk out spending thousands and get home and have all this flashy Gore-Tex flippity-flappity stuff. And we're like, wow, this stuff is so cool. Eventually, it just lands up in a pile somewhere. You know, some little African boys running around Malawi with my $100 Gore-Tex whatever because I just never.
On the other hand, you've ingratiated yourself to the locals that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Is there gifts as we go, what we're about.
Is there something that you didn't take with you? What's like the number one thing that you didn't take that you found out that you needed?
Money?
Absolutely. Yeah. Number one. Well, more money. More money. We could use more money. A blender. A blender would have been really useful.
But then we've got like the hand liquidizer that works perfectly fine as well.
If you use it.
Yeah. And you end up drinking the local juices that they make anyway. You know, the locals do local blending of juices, so why the hell take a blender with? It's just,
see, yeah. We can't agree even now.
I bet we could rig up a pretty cool PTO operated blender.
Yeah. That would be awesome.
I have seen one. I have seen one.
That's awesome.
So tell us more about the Kickstarter. What's it about? What does it get you? Are there different levels? And like, is it just $40 and you get a copy of the book, or what kind of spiffs do you get?
Okay, well, we've designed a bunch of stickers. Which the book and then the whole project is quite Land Rover centric, but any hashtag van life kind of person will also get a lot of value from it. But we designed a lot of stickers, we got postcards, some of our best photographs, we're turning them into postcards as well. We want to keep it quite simple. I know in a lot of Kickstarter program campaigns, they have a whole bunch of extras and this, that, and the other, but we really believe that the book is worth the effort and it's worth the campaign on its own. So we don't have a whole bunch of stuff that goes around it, but there are different tiers. So like for $10, you can get a bunch of stickers. $25 bucks, you can get stickers and postcards. $40, you get the book. And then what we're also going to be doing is on another tier is we'll be including the first book. We will be free. So for a high contribution, you'll be able to get the two books. And then we're also going to be making leather pouches with beautiful beaded what would you put, like a latch almost?
Yeah.
African beads that we've been carrying with us for the last 4 years, believe it or not. We're using that for latching. We're also going to be making, what else are we making?
More stuff you don't need to be carrying, huh?
Well, I to follow along with Harold's comment, I think I understand this now. You've identified boxes of things you don't need, and you're now going to sell them off to people through the Kickstarter, right? That's a joke.
Yeah. Great. Thanks. Yes, that's exactly what we're going to do. And then what I'm really, you know what, I wear, I'm not a very superstitious guy, but there's two things I always have with me when I travel, especially because I drive a Land Rover. The one is a St. Christopher medallion, a little magnetic one that's stuck up on the headliner. And the other one is a wooden bracelet. So whenever people say to me, so how's Land Rover running? I can rub the wooden bracelet and I can say, oh, she's doing fine, touch wood. And that's really why the Land Rover is being as reliable as she is. It's not about maintenance, it's about the wooden bracelet. In the Kickstarter campaign, there are going to be Land Rover wooden bracelets as one of the rewards. So you too can have a reliable Land Rover.
I think it's a great idea. There's a name of your book too, right? You too can have a reliable Land Rover.
Yes, that's option two. Yeah, option two. No, actually, no. The book is going to be called Travel the Planet Overland.
Oh, well, that's right. I've seen pictures. Right, you have a picture of your 130.
I think I saw that you posted up a sort of a competition to see who could choose the cover art.
Yeah, yeah, we did.
Has a decision been made?
Excuse me?
Has a decision been made?
We went completely opposite of we had, those were our final options, and then we were just messing around the one day, and then we came up with this new cover, and they just blew everything else out the water.
So in other words, thanks to everybody for your input. Here's what we're going to do instead.
Thank you for your guidance. We really appreciate your help, Harold.
All right.
By the time this gets posted, the Kickstarter will have been launched, and we will have a link in the show notes, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I know I'm surprising you with this, but anything special for our podcast listeners? If they support you, can they get anything, I don't know, anything special? Or not, that's fine, too. I know I should have asked you this ahead of time.
I think, I'll tell you what. If the podcast guys, if anyone can do a contribution with a link to the podcast, or I don't know how that works, but you could always do the stickers for me. Yeah. A couple of Land Rover stickers.
Maybe either of our listeners contacts you.
The one we made is very popular. Sorry?
You say if either of our listeners wants to contact you and say they heard about the Kickstarter from the podcast, then you'll do something for them?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, they could probably put CSP or something in the when they do
the notes
or something. They could probably indicate they heard you on the podcast. So yeah, there we go. So if you're listening to the podcast, and I won't post this anywhere. I'll just leave it in the audio portion here. If go out to the link in the show notes, and that'll take you to the Kickstarter, and then put in the comment there that you heard about it through the Center Steer podcast or CSP at least. And Graham and Louisa will do something special. I don't know. They're going to send you maybe some. Stickers or something along those lines. And does that include our international listeners? Because, you know, we do have people listen around the world. So I don't want that to be too expensive for you.
Absolutely. No problem.
Good, good. Well, there you go.
Little Easter egg for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, little bonus.
You have to listen to the show to get it.
That's right. Yes, just for the special podcast listeners.
Aren't you glad you didn't turn it off before now?
I think we interrupted a thought you had too. You were saying something about the stickers and other things. And did you get to finish your thought?
Well, yeah, one of my favorite stickers. I made it in South Africa before we left, and it says, "This is not a Jeep," and that's been extremely popular. A lot of people are, "Nice Jeep, man." I'm like, "This is not a Jeep. It's a Land Rover." And so that's been one of our most popular stickers. So we've made that up now for the Kickstarter campaign. So that'll be definitely a good one for the podcast guys.
Excellent.
The Land Rover.
And actually, when does that? How long is that running? Like, is that? Are you? You're not done with the book yet. I assume you have some more time. Is that? What's the length of period that the Kickstarter's going? I guess when the book comes out is when the Kickstarter ends. I assume.
No, the Kickstarter will run for a period of 30 days. So we'll launch it tomorrow, which will be the 25th of April, and then it'll run until the 26th of May. And then the book will actually come out in August. So it'll give us the time to finalize the book, and the printing, unfortunately, takes up to a month because we're not just doing your cheap digital printing. We're getting it done.
Yeah, it's going to be over 100 full color photos, as well as about 50,000-60,000 words. So it's going to be a bit more expensive to print, a lot more complicated than it was to print our first book. So that's going to take us a bit of time. And obviously it depends on the quantities. Obviously the more sales, I suppose, the more support we have, then we can look at do we have it printed in the States or in Asia or where we do it. So, and then we've got to consider in the shipping. So we're pretty much, I think, about two-thirds of the way finished with the actual design and the content of the book. It's putting it all together and getting it out there. By August, they should be, August, September, they'll be shipped out.
So that makes more sense then. Okay, so the Kickstarter runs for a month, and this will help to support the production of the book. So it's going to be a higher quality of production than you did on your previous book, sounds like. And so that's what the Kickstarter is going to help support.
Excellent.
Right.
Now, do ultimately you plan on having an ebook version of this as well?
Not for the Kickstarter, obviously, at the moment, but probably after the Kickstarter when, some people just want to keep it on handy, when they are traveling and they, there's recipes and that kind of thing. So they would be able to have it as an ebook as well. And I think we'll probably do soft cover for a lot of people as well.
Yeah, this is the thing about doing it through the Kickstarter. Afterwards, it'll be available through Amazon. But the thing is, with Amazon, is they print at a very, it's very cheap quality. The photos aren't going to be the quality that you're going to get through the Kickstarter campaign. It won't be a beautiful book. It will be a beautiful book, but it's not. It won't be as beautiful as it is now. Yeah. Cut that out, please, John.
It won't be the premium edition. See, the Kickstarter will get you the premium edition, just like you're buying a Range Rover.
We call that coffee table grade.
Yes. It'll be
That's pretty much it.
First edition will be the better, and obviously the second edition will be for the ones that are, that we produce locally.
Yes. So there we go. It's not you're creating through the Kickstarter the premium coffee table version of the book with a nice, wonderfully high produced quality photos. And then it'll all be put into the Kickstarter. So if you want the gift quality, high production value book, get in on the Kickstarter. You only have a month. By the time I get this posted, you'll probably be down to about 20 days. So get out to the link and support Graham and Louisa on this Kickstarter, because this will also directly support them and their efforts as they continue to drive the world.
Well, this is our entire motivation. Our entire motivation is to travel the world. And this is how we plan to do it. And we've had a great response to our first book. We're seeing amazing things and doing some pretty awesome things. And we really want to, do the whole world tour, get across, circumnavigate Eurasia maybe, and Australia and all of that, at the same time raising our kids. So obviously all the proceeds of this are going straight into helping to achieve our dream. Keep the wheels rolling.
Now, did I hear correctly that there's also going to be a continuation book of the We Will Be Free story?
That's right. Louisa, I was working on it, and she kicked me off it. She made me work on this campaign now because she likes to boss me around. I was really enjoying it. I was really getting into it. And that'll probably we've arranged now with the owners of the ranch. We're going to come back into the States. If all goes well, for the Overland Expo, which is happening in Flagstaff in May, I'll be at the author's table with my first book, along with a few notable authors from in the travel industry. And then we'll be coming back to Baja. So this year, we're basically using it to set ourselves up for the next 4 years of travel. So, yeah, we've been writing for Expedition Portal. We'll be getting out an adventure journal, getting some good media happening for us. And, the whole idea is to reinvent ourselves as professional overlanders.
Ooh.
I know.
Put a
professional.
You can put a PhD after your name. Overland PhD. Doctor.
Professor.
So
the sad thing about that is then we could no longer afford to have you on our show.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Don't want to price ourselves out of the market, because I can't afford the I can't afford the Range Rover.
We have to raise our subscription fees to both of our listeners.
That's right. Hey, we have three or four. Come on. All right. Not two. It's
do
like
what you
four.
Have to do, guys. Come on. Do what you have to do. We're worth it.
Well, I think thanks to you guys, we had a little uptick this past month in Brazilian and Venezuelan Facebook likes. So I wonder if that's thanks to you guys.
It probably is.
Yeah, maybe.
We've got a lot of Venezuelan and Brazilian friends. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
Brazil has got a very a thriving Land Rover community. They've got a Defender meetup once a year in a beautiful place called São Lourenço. We were lucky enough to go there while we were in Brazil. Land Rovers throughout Latin America, throughout the world, they're loved, they're cherished. The Brazilian guys are really passionate about the Land Rovers. And the beautiful thing about owning a Defender in Brazil is look at where they live. I mean, within a couple of days, they're in the Andes or they're in the Amazon or at the beach, and it's just fantastic. I highly recommend you guys going down there for a visit sometime.
Well, I think the cool thing about owning a Defender in Brazil is that you can own a Defender in Brazil.
True. Well, that's pretty much what true of any country, but here.
Any country that doesn't start with U.S.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, you guys, you do have Superman, a.k.a. Will Hedrick.
Doing the good work.
He certainly helps.
So you're going to go to, in May, you're going to be at the Overland Expo. What's happening after that? What's your plan for the next, say, 6 months or so?
Heading back down to Baja. We got to get over to California. We're going to go hang out in Death Valley for a while. We're getting itchy feet just sitting here working every day on the ranch. But after that, we'll come back down here for a few more months. The follow-up to We Will Be Free will be published probably in about October. It's a heck of a lot easier just doing a literal novel than trying to organize photos and negotiate with the wife. Writing my book, I can just write my book and she leaves me alone. So by October, that'll be published, and yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the idea is to head up to see you fine folk.
Yep.
It's about time.
Yeah.
I thought
hard to get.
I know you are,
because you get careful. If you wait too long, you're going to find that snow stuff again.
We're not scared of it anymore. It didn't kill us.
Oh,
we're not
okay.
Scared of
uh-huh.
It.
Uh-huh.
All right. Yeah. Get all Nietzsche about the snow now, huh?
I don't believe him. Well, you know, in October there is Overland Expo East. You may want to throw that into your consideration. And also there's MAR takes place, which is the Mid-Atlantic Rally. And that's our other guest on the show today. He's going to talk about MAR. Something to throw into your hat of places maybe to visit or something to do. Give you a reason to be here.
Well, yeah, when is MAR?
MAR is usually the first weekend, first full weekend of October. And that will be in Virginia. Yeah. That'll be in Virginia, not far from about 5 miles, 5 miles, 5 hours from the Pittsburgh area.
And as I recall, it's just plus or minus a week from the Eastern Overland Expo.
And I think Overland Expo is the weekend after, yeah, which is in North Carolina this year.
So. We might want to make an effort to get there a bit early then.
Yeah, and you're certainly welcome to use our area here as a base of operations.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yes.
Look forward to meeting you guys eventually.
But you better.
And I know of a particular shop in Western PA that does give safe haven to overlanders.
Indeed.
Ah.
As long as it does.
Grungy overlanders. You have to do stop take twice, once when they arrive and once when they leave.
That's right. Yes. And also once while they're there. You never
Big
know.
Big pressure washer.
And sticky fingers. We got the kids sticking and stuff. Well, thank you very much. We're going to take you up on that, I think.
Absolutely. How are the kids, by the way? How are they doing? I see that. Are they adjusting well these days to being in one place?
Yeah, they're loving it. Jessica, come say hello. This is Jessica. Hello, Jessica.
Oh, hi, Jessica. Hi. I follow you on Instagram, Jessica.
Thank you. I follow you, too.
I think you do. Yes. You've always have good photos. You provide good content to the world. It seems like all humans are good for anymore is content providers.
That's a bit abstract for my 11-year-old, John.
I thought that was more abstract for you. I think she probably would get it.
It might be true. Well, no, she's the puppy whisperer. She's very happy here because they've got two Australian healers. What we're trying to do is encourage our kids to work to their strengths, to find careers that they can be passionate about. And she's really passionate about animals, so she'll take any excuse to get out of her homeschooling to go scratch the dogs.
Oh, nice.
So their fierce guard dogs are now useless?
Absolutely. Absolutely useless. Yeah.
And so she can have more than a pet that's bigger than a fish now?
For a while.
Yep.
And then she can have photos of them.
Oh.
I would think traveling with a fish in a Land Rover might not work so well.
But we could always eat the fish.
Well, I think the bowl would leak itself dry in a short period of time. Then you'd have to eat the fish.
That's true. And how's your boy doing?
He's doing well. He's grown significantly.
Is that possible?
He's huge.
He's
turning 17 in July. He's probably about 6 foot two, probably about 250 pounds.
What?
He's huge. He's massive.
250.
Yeah.
That's
he's very. He should be at home playing rugby Because he's built for it, man. So, this is our problem. Like, how the hell do I fit that in my Defender?
I was going to say, you need a bigger truck, dude.
Yeah, we've got an issue. But he pretty much grew up in that back seat, though, so he's kind of – he knows how to fill the little spaces. So, yeah, he's still comfortable. He just doesn't realize he should be really at home.
Well, there you go. Well, hopefully we'll get to meet everybody in a few months when you make it to the eastern United States.
Excellent. I can't wait.
That'd be fun. It'll be fun. And I'll give you a little tour of all the local breweries. We can have some fine beers.
We'll have some bries.
We'll have some bries. Or
Braise.
And he says it properly,
yeah? And he says it properly. And you know what? I miss American meat. I tell you what. This down here in Mexico, I'm tired of eating donkeys as dressed up as freaking ribeye. Yeah. I miss American ribs.
We appreciate you calling in, giving us the update. I know your connection there to Baja is not the best, but it seems held out well. We've had no video this time, which is okay, because while we get to look at a picture of Louisa.
Video costs extra.
Yes, it does. And all right, so Kickstarter is going to kick off this week. By the time I get this posted, it should be out there. We'll have a link in the show notes. And if you're a podcast listener, and you please go out to the if you wish to support their Kickstarter, mention that you heard it on the podcast, and they'll hook you up with a sticker or two or something special. Not sure what they're going to do for you yet, but
little something nice,
a little something extra for the effort. And
absolutely.
Anything else you guys want to mention or cover before we let you go?
One question. Are the Kickstarter books going to be autographed?
It depends on the category.
Ooh, that costs extra.
Yeah, it does, actually. The more you pay, the nicer we are to you.
imagine that.
That's just like life. You're buying your friends.
Well, there are a couple restaurants out there where the more you pay, the ruder they are to you. But
I'm pretty good at being rude, so I could be rude if you pay enough. I don't know. You know, like right now we just need money, so whatever you want, I'll do it.
All right. So it's by request, okay.
Well, you guys be well, and thanks for calling in. And it was great talking with you, and good luck with the Kickstarter.
Thank you very much, guys. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
The Center Steer Podcast is proud to have our first sponsor, LTW Knives. LTW Knives are handcrafted in Ohio with the finest locally sourced materials. They build everything from everyday carry to bushcraft and even overland specific. Everything that LTWK builds comes with a lifetime guarantee and is designed from the ground up to be a solid working knife. Each piece is constructed with survival in mind, knives with a proven international pedigree that have been there and back. Bushcraft, hunting, camping, overland, and everyday carry models are available. Our new Bushcrafter HC is an excellent example of an everyman knife, able to do everything from help get the campfire started to skinning game. Being made from 3/32 1075 steel and with a convex edge, it will resharpen easily in the field. These heirloom quality pieces will outlast your adventure, so plan well, drive safely, and carry an LTWK. Find out more online at ltwrightknives.com or centersteer.com/LTWK. And now it's time for the Heritage segment on the Center Steer podcast, and we switch over to our Heritage correspondent. Do you like being called the Heritage correspondent?
I do, yeah, that works.
Heritage contributor Morgan, who's owner and operator of SeriesParts.com.
Well, thank you very much. So I think we've pretty thoroughly gone through all of the Series Land Rovers. So at this point, we're going to just sort of switch over to the Range Rover Classic. So what we now refer to as the Range Rover Classic was actually released in 1970 as just the Range Rover. And it was a then new luxury SUV from the Rover Company to bring the comforts of their cars to the 4x4 market. And continuing in the naming scheme that they had started with Land Rover, they just sort of incorporated the Rover part of that into the name. So just calling it the Range Rover instead of some other Rover model designation.
So this was part of the Rover car company at the time?
It was, yes.
Oh, okay. As was Land Rover.
I guess I kind of knew that. So the Range Rover was not really a model of the Land Rover, more than a model of Rover cars.
As was Land Rover.
It was as was Land Rover.
Okay. Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
There was the Land Rover and the Range Rover.
Under the Rover car company.
Right.
And then they also had the Rover car P something, and they had a bunch of other cars.
Right.
Okay. Right. All right. Hey, look, I learned something. It's pretty cool. Okay. Let's see. This segment's pretty good.
I think what was cool also is that in the development of the Range Rover, they also had a product briefly they were toying with called the Road Rover.
Yes. And the Range Rover has some of its roots in that Road Rover project, which they started in 1958 with the goal of making a 4x4 with, like the Range Rover, a more comfortable ride. So this was an early experiment where they used just a series Land Rover chassis and drivetrain and everything and put a car-like body and interior on it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was an interesting project. It's not...
Not the most aesthetic.
No. there's actually a... Somewhat related to what we discussed earlier, another route to the Range Rover, which is there was a Series 2 modified with a Buick V8 that was sent to Rover by the president of Land Rover USA, which was to show the benefits of a more powerful Land Rover. This ended up resulting in them starting a project and Rover acquiring the tooling for the Buick V8. From GM back in 1965. And then obviously that got used in the Range Rover, the Stage 1 V8, and all sorts of other vehicles.
And pretty much everything British for quite a while actually used that engine.
Yes, it's if you look at the Buick V8, it is almost every British vehicle.
The one well, besides Rolls-Royce, the only
True.
Other big standout is Jag.
Yep.
Jag went as far as to make sure their cars had an engine bay too narrow to fit the Rover V8 because they did not want it forced on them by the British Leyland.
Oh, that's funny.
Now, was the Buick V8 all the way up until the Ingenium came out?
Rover V8 stopped production in 2005 when they started putting the Jag engines in.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. By the 1960s, because the Road Rover project was like 1958, by the 60s, the SUV market in the U.S. was in full swing with the likes of the Ford Bronco, the International Harvester Scout, the Jeep Wagoneer, all of those. And the Land Rover Series 2 had really changed very little from what the original Land Rover was, which was introduced in 1948, so it was still leaf-sprung, had very little in the way of creature comforts in the cab aside from padded seats, and was still powered by four-cylinder engines. So it really wasn't in the same market at all compared to the rest of the burgeoning SUV market. So in 1967, Rover started the 100-inch station wagon project, which was headed by Charles Spencer King, and that would ultimately become the Range Rover. And development of the new powertrain for the 100-inch station wagon was actually shared with the project for what became the Ford Control 101. So using that... Buick V8, which was then the Rover V8. And it also used a new permanent four-wheel drive gearbox with high and low range. The Series Land Rover was not permanent four-wheel drive. And the Rover V8 is actually an aluminum alloy engine, so both light and powerful compared to the Series engines. Another big change from the original Land Rover, the 100-inch station wagon project used long travel coil suspension instead of the leaf springs to provide a more comfortable ride, as well as actually improving off-road performance.
And high-speed stability.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's also some issues with high-speed stability on the early Range Rovers, but... we'll probably cover that in a later installment of the Heritage segment.
The important thing to know, however, is that high-speed stability had never been designed into the product because Land Rovers never achieved high speed.
Right, and that was one of the things that they certainly saw with that sort of Series 2 that was converted to a V8. So they got to experiment with all of that. Supposedly, the decision for going with coil suspension was also in part because they were test driving the Rover P6, which had coil suspension on some dirt tracks and stuff like that. Although they also purchased, much like they did with the original Land Rover, where it was inspired by the Jeep, they purchased a Ford Bronco for their research and development. So, and that was coil sprung as well. So it was probably a combination thereof and all sorts of other engineering factors. And additionally, on the drivetrain, they went with four-wheel disc brake all around, another big step up from the series Land Rovers. And somewhat similar to the series Land Rovers, the station wagon project used aluminum body panels. However, instead of being an all-aluminum body mounted to a steel chassis, they had the same steel chassis, but they had a steel safety frame, which was mounted to the chassis, and then the exterior body panels, which were Burma Bright, were bolted to that. So that was, you know, to improve rigidity, still maintain some of the lightweight properties and corrosion resistance. And actually, interestingly, Rover's stylus, David Bach or Bosch, I'm not sure the pronunciation there. He was originally intended to design those outer body panels, but the ones made by the engineering team were actually so good that he basically just focused on some of the other smaller styling elements like the grille and headlights. So in that way, it was very similar to the Land Rover, where the just original engineering was very much what went live. And as you can probably guess from the project's name, the Range Rover was a 100-inch wheelbase. They stuck with that for quite a while. It was, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, a two-door for quite a while until 1981. And then they introduced a four-door model. So full 11 years of two-door only.
Wow.
Yeah. And then in 1992, so another basically 10 years later, they added a longer 108-inch wheelbase just to provide more legroom to the rear passengers. And that existed until the end of the run, which was 1995 year model, but in 2006. And around, I think it was around 94 was when they introduced the actual Range Rover Classic name, just adding Classic to the Range Rover, because they had BMW purchased the Land Rover division. They came out with the P38 Range Rover, and so they actually sold side by side for a period there, and that's when they started adding the Classic badge. So Range Rover Classic was actually an official name for that short period of time.
Here in the United States only, or around the world?
You know, I'm not entirely sure on whether it was U.S. only. Those long wheelbase models were named differently in the U.S. versus the U.K. and other markets. I believe it was first as the HSE in the U.K., but here in the U.S. it was the County. So then it became the County Classic in 1994 when they came out with the Range Rover. But yeah, that's basically the introduction to the Range Rover Classic.
So the clamshell hood / bonnet,
yes.
Was that made by the gentleman you said that did the design, or was that the engineers that came up with it? Because that's apparently a styling element that has continued throughout all Range Rovers.
You know, I'm not entirely sure whether he modified that much. From my research, it shows that he only did some of the minor body line styling. So I believe that was actually part of the original design.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because that's like one of the telltale signs of a Range Rover that's continued, as I said, throughout the whole, is that clamshell bonnet hood. So, interesting.
Exactly. Yeah, and basically the engineers had to make some panels to put on the body for them to do their road tests before the design was actually completed, because they were designing it with the safety frame. So they sort of came up with this styling. Obviously, they had an original concept in mind anyway, but they went with that. And the designer basically came in, and I think he was actually officially called Rover's stylist, because he wasn't actually doing the overall vehicle design, just advising and changing elements. He expected to redo all of those panels, and they just found they liked them enough that he added some lines to them and did the minor effects like the grill and headlamps.
What about the floating roof line? Did you see anything about that, where that came from? You know, because that's another Range Rover element, is that floating roof line where all the pillars are blackened and, you know, the roof is usually body color.
Right. No, I didn't find anything on that. I can't remember if – I don't think they were always the floating roof line, because they didn't actually add the black vinyl on the rear pillars until much later.
Yeah. Maybe that – yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess you get what you pay for, right? How much did we pay you to do the research?
Very little.
Indeed, yes.
But I do it for fun. So. You,
absolutely, absolutely. What's happening in the upcoming segments? What's the plan?
Well, very similar to the series Land Rovers, we'll sort of dive into various components and explore the drivetrain and such. Because the Range Rover did have a number of developments in terms of new gearboxes, and obviously the Rover V8 changed during that time, and they did have diesel options, stuff like that.
Good deal. When did they become? They were always stick, right? They did not start off as an automatic, did they?
Right. They started as manual transmissions, and they switched, I believe. I think it was the mid-80s. I'll have to double check on the dates, but I believe it was the mid-80s when they added automatic.
Thanks very much, Morgan, for this month's Heritage segment as we move into Range Rovers.
Well, thank you.
I guess, or Range Rover Classic to be.
Or the Jaguar Land Rover Range Rover Classic.
Classic.
I might have missed a classic in there.
I think you missed a classic, yeah.
Right. Jaguar Land Rover Classic Range Rover Classic.
Of the Rover Cars Range Rover Classic.
Yes.
Well, that actually explains, too, one of the reasons why they end up calling Land Rover here North America, Range Rover North America, because they were not part of this. They were the same company, but they were not the same. They were two different models under the same company. That
well, and sense. And the other thing is, too, is that after Land Rover pulled out of sales in North America in the early 70s, they brought back in the mid-80s the Range Rover, but not the Land Rover.
Right.
So it was Range Rover America, okay. Because that's all they were going to sell.
Welcome back to the podcast. It is the Center Steer Podcast, episode number 37. Now, our second guest this month is David Short. He is the treasurer of Rove, which is Rover Owners of Virginia. Did I get that right? That is Rove, isn't it? What it stands
Rover
for?
Rover Owners Association of Virginia.
Rover right. Owners Association of Virginia. And for the last, well, my very first proper Land Rover off-road event was MAR, and MAR's Mid-Atlantic Rally. And that's, I went to 2002. And so first we're going to start talking about MAR, and what I will use the word, it's back. There's been some fallow years, I suppose. And so, David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
So you are the treasurer of Rove, and Rove, as I said, is the Rover Owners Association of Virginia. And so tell us a little bit about Rove, and then maybe we'll tell us about MAR.
Okay. Well, you got it right. The Rovers Owners Association of Virginia, ROAV.org, if you look us up on the internet. We are one of the nation's oldest Land Rover brand-centric clubs. We were founded in 1975, and we were lucky enough to have such a long relationship with Land Rover corporate that we're allowed to use the Land Rover symbol and associate with the brand. So we've got a pretty long history with the Land Rover brand and been around in the area or in the world for a while. We started out with the Mars back in the 70s as well, the Mid-Atlantic Rallies, and they've grown from just small events at one of our members' houses over at Penland Farm. Mike McKay, he offered up his farm for this back in the early days. And it's grown through a series of events, I think, in the 2000s when I think you and I both joined into the club and kind of saw the first our first Mars. we were at Pearl's Pond, and the event was getting right. quite huge. I think in 2004, 2006, in that genre, we had almost 400 attendees, which was just off the charts.
Yep, I remember that.
And those were great times. But like a lot of clubs that are experiencing, not just Land Rover clubs, but off-road clubs experiences, it's hard to find space and land and places to hold these events. And Mar outgrew Pearl's Pond, and the landowner there wanted us to kind of move on and find greener pastures. And that was kind of tough. So the club had a challenge of kind of bouncing around between a couple of different venues and finding some places where we could put down roots. And we struggled for a few years to find that. And one year we actually could not find a spot to actually have an event that year. So we joined forces with the Conclave up at the, at the Cove up in Northern Virginia, out near the Winchester area.
Right.
And that year kind of was kind of it kind of put a shadow over what people were thinking about what Mar was going to, or what the Rove Club was doing, or what Mar was doing. But after that year, we were able to secure space down on a farm near Blacksburg, Virginia. It's actually in Pembroke, Virginia, just a little bit west of Blacksburg, down southwest Virginia. And we've been there ever since. And this is our fourth or fifth year down at in Giles County, Pembroke, Virginia. And that's where our Mar is scheduled for this fall, September 30th through October 2nd, 2016, down there. And we've been building this venue up for a couple of years now, and it's been pretty exciting because we're able to go back to the same venue. We've got a great relationship with the landowner. He's actually a member of the club. He owns this farm that we're on and this mountainside. And we've been going back to this venue for year after year, developing some trails, expanding the trail network, really bedding in and maturing the process, and really building out the course there. And the trails are just the kind of cross promote. The trails are pretty good there, and they've been used by some guy called Bill Burke. I'm not anybody's ever heard of him before.
But yes, we are. Well aware.
Bill Burke has used the some of our trails off Mar time frame during the summertime to hold some of his driving schools out in Virginia.
Oh wow, that's good to know.
Yeah, so it's a good endorsement that they're good enough to challenge some of the greatest in the business.
Yeah. How close to the James River?
We're not anywhere at all close to the James River. So the flooding that we've experienced in the past is not really a challenge. However, last year we brought the rain with us, and it's a running joke. Mar stands for mud and rain, not Mid-Atlantic Rally.
That's right.
I remember those monsoon years.
It wouldn't be Mar if it wasn't rain. Come on.
Exactly. Yeah. Last year I forget the exact total, but it was inches and inches over days of rain. But we still had over 100 people out there standing in the rain, cooking steaks and lamb chops and drinking adult beverages and just having a great old time. Good. And the trucks were having a good time on the on our trials course. They were still challenged up on the mountain, getting around in the slop, and it was still a great time. You know, Land Rovers don't really need sunshine to have a good time, and the Mar is for those types of guys.
Yeah, that sounds great. I think back fondly on the years I went to Mar, because it was always a fun event and fun. And that's actually the inspiration. Mar has a link to the podcast itself, because that's the inspiration for the podcast, was people sitting around the fire talking about their trucks and their interests, and that's really the main concept for the podcast. So that's a link back to my experience at the Mar event. It was always an enjoyable time, so especially with my Freelander, and I got to show people that the Freelander could do something. Pembroke, how far is that from D.C.? I know there's a lot of folks in the D.C. area that have big Land Rover following there, and I think a lot of your members are from that area. Is it close? I'm just trying to gauge the...
That's a trick question now, because how far is it in terms of miles? How far is it in terms of time, and how far is it in Land Rover time? Series time. See, I drive a Stage One, which is kind of the faster of the series, but it still takes its time poking down the road. But I live up near Dulles Airport in Northern Virginia myself, and it's a loose 5 hours, five and a little bit of change to get down there. I think if you've got a little fancier car, a little faster time frame, you can make it a little better.
Right.
But it's a bit over 200 miles from Northern Virginia. It's a bit of a drive. But it's not that bad of a drive. Straight down 81, and you get off at 460, you go through Virginia Tech, and you pop out the other side, and there you are.
Okay. I have a general sense of where that is. I had a chance to look it up on the map. So, well, that's cool. And so what actually takes place at Mar? I when I went, there was always there was a big dinner, and there was an auction, and then folks could kind of go off-road as they pleased. Does that still take place? Does that still happen, or are there different events now?
It's still we still keep it to the basic tenets of Mars. Folks want to get around, hang out, look at trucks, tell stories and lies about how cool their trucks are, and then go off and get their tires dirty. and that's pretty much the what we try to keep focused on for Mars. So the general theme for Mars is you show up on Friday evening. We have trail rides out in the afternoons and the evenings. We have trail rides again all day on Saturday, different levels. And the great part about this property we have now is it's got about 8.5 miles of Forest Service road, which is great for the shiny set that doesn't want to go out and tear the trucks apart, but they do have these. This forest road is it's an older Forest Service road, and it's been moved left or right through the woods. Where they've moved it and kept the road nice and clear, to the right where it used to be is a huge chug hole or a truck swallowing swamp now. So it's great fun to go down this road, and you can stay on the high gravel and watch your friends take their trucks and jump them into these mud holes and have a good old time, and you can still keep your truck, you know, on the gravel and have a safe time there. So that's a nice that forest road's a nice loop around the area, and then we have some intermediate and advanced trails that are actually on the mountain, different a little small rock garden we have for people to play on, and it's just a lot of different varying terrain there. So we have the terrain all Saturday, and then Saturday night is we usually have a vendor come in, and I've got a line on a good vendor that does an amazing banana pudding for dessert, if you're into that type of thing.
Food's
it's
important.
A homemade grandmother's banana pudding made from some country recipe from some back hills thing there, but it's really good. And so we have a vendor come in, and they do dinner for us. And then we have and with all of our sponsors, we've got really committed and loyal sponsors, and they've usually provide us with tables and tables of giveaways and things to raffle off.
Oh, yeah.
And that helps with the club and generates a lot of enthusiasm and offsets some of the costs of the event as well.
I always enjoy the auction. Yeah, the auction was always a lot of fun.
Yeah, we've trying to get a couple more events. I don't want to open up and say something about events we have because they're still in the works, but we're trying to expand a little bit. We're trying to expand smartly and cautiously, not to dilute what's going on, but to keep some focused things there. We were in talks with some Lucky 8 guys that help out. They're one of our great sponsors to help out with some of the things that we could, some other things we could do during the Mar. We tried to do it last year, but the rain kind of put a damper on that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the general gist, though. Go out and drive around, have a nice dinner on Saturday night. Everyone talks about everything they broke and fixed, and we have a good raffle giveaway. We do a little drive on Sunday morning to get the last bit of it out of your system, and then everyone packs up and goes home.
Yeah. So when does registration open? How much is the cost? And what do you get? Do you still get a T-shirt?
Well, we haven't set the registration cost yet because we're still in a rove cycle of events here. And you'll kind of let me not answer that question, but answer another one.
Sure.
We just finished our Rovers at Wintergreen event, actually just last weekend, which is we have our fourth annual spring event at Wintergreen Ski Resort. And I'm just finished out mailing the last T-shirts this week for that and tidying up some of the loose ends for that. We're getting ready to prep up for our next event, which is just a kind of a real low key summer parts swap meet in June 11th. That's going to be kind of just a great chance. I'm trying to pimp it really hard because I'm trying to clear the stuff out of my garage because my wife wants the garage clear.
Imagine that.
So where's that located?
That's going to be located down at Pinland Farm. Mike McKeg's offered his farm up again this year. We're going to go down there. We had there last year. Just an event there. You can do a little camping. You set out a tarp, get rid of all the parts in your garage. Everyone just passes the parts off to the person to the left of them. Basically, that's what happens every year. You unload yours, come back with a new set. But that's our next event we're trying to prep up for. Once we get that event cleared off in June, then we'll start hard and heavy on the MAR planning. Registration should open up probably in the July timeframe, July, August, September, and then the event will be held the last week of September, first week of October, September 30 through October 2nd. The cost, we haven't just really set the cost yet. I can tell you last year it was about $100, and I think we're trying to keep it under $100, trying to keep everything affordable for everyone, but still got to cover our costs for the insurance and for the,
right.
We had a little bit of field repair work we had to cover the cost for last year. So we want to make sure we cover those kind of expenses as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I know. And I always recall that the insurance was like the bigger cost of the event from what I understood back in the day. So.
Well, I can't imagine why liability insurance on an event like this would be expensive.
That's true. And you automatically became a member of Rove, if I'm not mistaken, just because that's how the insurance coverage was.
Exactly. Yeah. So every event is a members only event. So when you register for the event, you register to become a member, and our insurance, so they're club events, and that keeps the insurance carrier happier, and it keeps our costs low. We actually do pretty well on our insurance costs. We've talked to some other clubs and some other sponsors of other events, and we've had such a long standing relationship with our insurance carrier, with Touch Wood, No Claims, that they've either foolishly or wisely continued to keep us as a customer. And yeah. It's not cheap, but it's what we found is it's reasonable and very competitive rates for keeping the events going this year for a full year of events.
That's impressive for not having a claim. That's for all the years you've been doing it, and for all the trucks that show up and all the people that are there. That's impressive.
It's a tribute to the members. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. So what anything else that goes on besides, so Rove does Mar, you talk about the event you just had, which I've already forgotten the name, and then you're having a part swap. Anything else going on with the club?
The Rovers at Wintergreen, R-A-W, Raw, and then we have the part swap this summer, and then Mar in the fall. Those are the big three events. We have in the February timeframe, January, February timeframe, we have our annual board meeting, where we get all the members there or whoever wants to show up. And we usually show up around Central Virginia, elect new officers, go over the balance sheet of the club, plan out and approve the dates and finances for the next year, just take care of all the club business type of stuff. But those are the big events for the year. We try to keep it simple, and we try to keep a rhythm going so we can build up some reliability and so people can plan around the club events. Because I know in this area, we're spoiled for choice in the Mid-Atlantic area right now. Like when we just did this past few weekends, if you're a Land Rover guy, you may have heard of the Safari down in North Carolina, held by the I think it's Croc that does the Uari Safari still, mm-hmm. Carolina Rovers Owners Group.
I believe so.
And then the next weekend was us at the Rovers at Wintergreen, and then the next weekend was SCAR. Of course, not really a Mid Atlantic event, but that's three weekends in a row, big Land Rover events, right in a row in the fall. Which is going to be kind of fun this year in the fall. I'll kind of jump into this if you don't mind. We're doing our event, the MAR, September 30th through October 2nd, that weekend. And we've had a little bit of trouble in the past with scheduling conflicts with the fine folks from the Expo, the Overland Expo folks.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But this year they are doing the Expo the week after MAR, not the same weekend as MAR.
Thank you.
And Expo is only about 3 hours from the MAR venue. So there's a little bit of talk about some crazy diehards that may just extend the camping at MAR and then head down early to Expo in Asheville and make a two-weeker out of it, which could be two weekends in a row at it, which could be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then if you want to hang on, if you're a real diehard, you can hang on and catch the Old North State event that back at Owari the third weekend of October. But that's a weekend break between there, so you don't do three weekends in a row again.
Right.
But it's difficult to get everything slotted in, scheduled in, with all these events happening in the East Coast area. So we try to keep our dates solid and our events regular and keep a kind of rhythm going so people can plan around that.
Right. I, for one, want to thank you for splitting up those two events, the Overland Expo and MAR, because I want to attend both this year. So thank you.
Yeah, I've always wanted to attend the Overland Expo, but being one of the huge planners for MAR, it's kind of hard for me to skip out on the MAR and say, guys, I'm out.
Right.
I'm going to go down and look at the Expo.
Yeah, exactly. I almost attended MAR last year, but I think I had a work commitment come up and I couldn't make it. But and then I was like, oh, and then of course now I want to attend the Overland Expo, and last year they were in the same event the weekend. Anyways, I'm glad you've split them up. Good news. That's excellent. It's good to hear.
I should have opened up with this, but I want to close with this, is that our president's Bob Steele. He's been president for a long time, and he would have been here today and helped you guys out with the podcast. He's got a personal commitment today, and he couldn't make it. But Bob does send his greetings out to you guys, and he's excited about being part of the podcast, and the club's part excited about being part of the podcast. So thanks for having us on.
Well, he said you were a better face than he was, so.
it depends what day of week it is. Another plug for the club. We've really been working hard on our electronic presence, our social media presence over the past year. We've really built up our Facebook page, and we've worked on our webpage quite a bit. So you can hit us on www.roav.org, or you can get us on the Facebook at the ROAV. And we're really keeping a lot of information up there. The web page is kind of static with a lot of the static details, but we're keeping updates and moment to moment type of thing on the Facebook because it's easier to keep those things updated. But those are great things to check in, like us there, and keep an eye on what's going on. We always post updates to events and try to post pictures. There's a lot of great pictures posted up on Facebook now from the Rovers at Wintergreen event we had just the last weekend. So if you're excited to miss that, you can see a lot of great things there.
Yeah, I'll make sure that those links are in the show notes. So if you're not familiar with the links, go out to our show and to this episode, and we'll have links to Rove and to your Facebook page. I think I can do a link to the Facebook page. But that's good. Yeah, I'll have to join up on the Facebook page because I haven't joined you guys there yet. And your website is where you'll be announcing registration, and that's where registration will take place for the MAR event itself?
Yeah, we've already got a little bit of information out there. That gives you the date and the location so you can start, marking times off in your calendar. Once we clear out of the June part swap, we'll start doing some work weekends for our members that are kind of local. There's a lot of it's a lot of work going into clearing the trails, whacking the weeds back down and trying to keep everything, trimming the limbs back to make sure the trails are open and clear. I know some people like just bushwhacking through the woods with their trucks, and some of the Range Rover set doesn't quite like, pinstriping the paint. So we try to keep trails that are good for everybody. So it takes a lot of work. So we have a couple of work weekends, usually about 3 or 4 work weekends before the actual event. And those are good fun. There's a lot of hard work, but it's also good fun because you get out there and run the trails before anybody else does.
Are you looking for volunteers for that? So
when the webpage, when we get those dates set, the webpage will update those on the dates, and then we'll start soliciting volunteers. Any member is welcome to show up. There's no cost to show up for work weekend. Everyone shows up, brings some tools, and just starts slaying the weeds on the mountainside.
So why don't we talk about you then, David? How did you get into Land Rovers? How did you get bit by the bug and get the disease? Has it been lifelong, or was there some pivotal moment?
It always goes back to the wife, doesn't it?
I don't know. Does it?
Not always.
So a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I went to school in Sweden and married a British girl. That's another whole story that would take two podcasts to go through. But I brought a British lass home to America, and we're married and we're living the happy life. And before I went overseas to school, I had a motorcycle. And as a young lad, you like to go ride your motorcycle fast and all those great things. And so as a young married lad, I said, I'm going to get a motorcycle. And then I realized I wasn't making decisions on my own anymore.
Indeed.
And my wife persuaded me that it probably wasn't in everyone's best interest for me to get back on two wheels. So I said, I want a toy to play with. I said, can I get a toy car? And she said, sure. So I was looking, I said, why don't I get a nice British car? When I was young, my dad and I rebuilt, dad had a Spitfire Mark III, 69, and we rebuilt that one. And we did a couple of cars when I was young. He really got me into the turning wrenches and taught me a lot about working on cars when I was, in junior high school and so forth. So we rebuilt a couple of cars, and you have your Freelander cross to bear. I had a TR7 when I was in high school.
Well, I've never heard that from Harold before, ever. You've elicited something from
that
him.
That was the Triumph that was meant to be an MG.
Oh, so.
And
so
not
I
in
to,
the
I
best way
cars.
Of that.
I had a TR7, so I learned how to work on cars. But I had
frequently.
This affinity for British craftsmanship. And so I looked at the Mini and I looked at the Land Rover, and the Minis that I could import at the time in my cost bracket were all just rust buckets, and because they're all metal, obviously all steel. And the Land Rovers with the Brembo-Brite, they offered a bit, naively, I thought they offered a bit more stability in the rust department.
Oh,
and I
sure.
thought I could take
what
the top
could go
of the Land Rover and make it a summer vehicle, where the Mini, you can't get a Mini with air conditioning, an old 60s Mini with an air conditioning. So I went and got a Land Rover, let me try this thing out. So I got a 1973 short wheelbase Series 3 as my first Land Rover back in 2000. And it's been downhill ever since.
Well, that's the only way to get it to move is to go
downhill.
Yeah.
Well, they do go faster that way.
They do.
Yeah. So I had a really interesting Series 3. It had a great story associated with it. I just fell into it. I got it off of cars.uk.co. My father-in-law still lives over in England at the time. He still lives over in England. And so I found this car on the internet. Had him go look at it. He said it was a piece of crap Land Rover, because they just think Land Rovers are all pieces of crap over in the UK.
I'll take it.
Yeah. So I paid a couple dollars for it, a couple pounds. And it was actually featured on Land Rover World magazine in 1996 as
Whoa.
A cover girl, if you will.
Cool.
And it was and if you kind of take your head back into the Wayback Machine, and if you can imagine a time in the early 90s when you had a plethora of old bare bones basic series trucks in the UK, and the Defenders were coming out into the market strong in the mid 90s. They were a little bit more luxurious. I say Land Rover luxurious, you know, it's all qualitative.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So this lad in Dartmoor was taking series trucks and dressing them up like Defenders, putting the county stripes on them, putting high back seats in them. High back seats were very luxurious in that time frame for a series truck. And a little bit of carpet on the kick wells, kick panels of the cab and stuff like that. Little accoutrement that really tuned up a series truck. And he called them the Highlander package. And if you look at some, if you go back through your stack of old magazines from the '90s, you may see these Highlanders advertised. And there's a red one with white stripes. It looked like the county stripes. And that was the truck. It was a 73 that he rebuilt and tuned up in the '90s. And you know, now that's pretty much kind of ho-hum boring. Everyone takes an old truck and fixes it up. But at the time, it was kind of interesting. And they had a bunch of magazines article about this guy doing that work. So that my truck was one of those trucks. And I got it in, like I said, in 2000. Of course, when I got it, it had already lived its second life and it was done.
Yeah.
And I had it for, I had it until 2005. I had it about five years. And it broke in half. The frame gave way on it. It was the rust.
That's fixable.
Well, I was moving house at the time, and the truck was really hard to shift. I came back from an Arari event, and it was really hard to shift. I couldn't figure out why it was hard to shift. Then I realized that the transmission cross member and the frame at the transmission cross member had rotted out and broke through, and the transmission was hanging on the drive chain.
Mm-hmm.
So that put a lot of tension on the transmission. That's why it was hard to shift.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I went to Home Depot and bought a piece of $2 angle iron scab steel, just something to, and I propped up the transmission with that piece of angle iron and threw some carriage bolts, some sheet metal screws through the whatever left of the frame to hold it up so it would take the tension off the transmission. And I drove it around the parking lot. Okay, so it would drive okay. And then I went and I said, you know, I don't have the time or resources to fix this. And so I sold it. And then I went on to my next truck. I'll have you know that truck, without any frame repair, drove on for 3 to 4 more years. And it drove from Baltimore all the way up to Minnesota. The next few owners kept in touch with me. And they said they'll fix the frame eventually. But it off-roaded for many a year with just that sheet metal screws and angle iron holding the transmission in. So God bless the series truck.
Yeah.
But I upgraded to the Stage 1 in 2006, which is the greatest. I think I'm very partial, but it's the greatest series truck ever made. I don't know why they never did put the 3.5 liter V8 in the series trucks until 1980, but they should have done it in the 70s when they had it in the Range Rover. But it's I have the Stage 1, which is if you're not familiar with the brand, it's the last of the series, the first of the Defenders. It's the mix between the two. They made them for 3 years, 80 to 83, and it's basically a leaf sprung 109 with a 3.5 liter V8 factory motor in it on the LT95 transmission, 3.54 gears front and rear on the differentials. The axles are a little bit unique because they're not the coil sprung axles because they're on leaf sprung chassis, so they're a little bit narrower than the coil sprung axles. So there's a bit peculiarity and uniqueness to the axle parts, which makes them hard to fix sometimes. But it's this 3.5 liter motor in the Stage 1 is most of the springy crowd, the coil spring crowd will scoff at them and say it's a small motor, has no power, it's under everything. But if you go to a series guy and he's running 70 horsepower from his 2.25 petrol motor, and you say you can get 100 to 125 out of this V8, they think that the heavens opened up to them.
Yeah, it's a huge upgrade.
And it's a great upgrade, and it's not so much of an upgrade that it overpowers the truck or takes you places you don't want to go. It's just it's a lot of torque and a lot of that just enough of that extra power that you need, and it gets me to Maine and back at highway speeds every year for the winter off.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, so I went to the Stage 1 in 2006, and I've had that now. Since then, I've put 50,000 miles on it, I think, in 10 years, and just wearing the wheels off. And in fact, if earlier you saw, I had the wheel off it just now.
Yep.
I've blown an oil seal on the front axle, and it did soak the whole brake drum with oil, as they do. And so I have parts on order from the UK coming any day now.
Oh, good. Well, so it's not your daily, though, it sounds like.
Well, I I used to work in D.C., and so the daily was the Metro train. But I changed jobs. And I started working for myself now. I work from home, and so I don't really commute anymore. So I do drive the Land Rover quite a bit to the grocery store, to the, you know, wherever I got to go. I just goof around with it now.
Good.
It's a lot more than I used to. In fact, my handle is Fireman Short. A lot of people know me on the I'm a volunteer firefighter in Northern Virginia. And I did get a chance. There was a brush fire a couple days ago, about 2-3 weeks ago. And I had a chance to take the Land Rover out through the woods on the brush fire. And I was running command as the fire chief from the Land Rover, which was kind of exciting.
Cool. That's very cool. That is very cool. That's that. Yeah, there you go. And Land Rover doing something important for important people.
There you go.
Nice. Have you owned any other Land Rovers or any other currently? Is just those two?
Well, those are the two that I've owned. Seriously, I stumbled into a Range Rover P38 at one time in my life because a friend of mine said, "Hey, David, you know about Land Rovers. Help me out with this one."
Uh-huh. That's how it always starts.
But that was a success story. This guy had a P38, and I opened the hood up, and there was all kinds of new parts on the motor. And I could tell this guy's been throwing parts to this thing for a long time, and he was stick a fork in it, done with this truck. And he just said, "Hey, for $800, give me the truck. I'll take the truck off my hand." And I looked at it, and I, long story short, I figured out I could probably fix it and get it running again. And I did, and I flipped it pretty quick and made about $2,000 off it, which I was pretty happy.
Yeah.
So then I got overconfident and cocky, and I bought a disco. I thought I'd do the same thing with it, and I lost my shirt on it. So yeah, I tried to flip a couple and had mixed luck, but the Series 3 and the Stage 1 are the ones I really drive.
Nice. There is balance in the Land Rover world. So
yeah, yes,
there are. That's usually what happens.
I got into Rove because of Bar. I was doing a lot of research online before I bought my Land Rover with the on the forums back in the 90s, and the Guns N' Rovers forum is where I got started on. And I think a lot of folks, I'm sure everyone's familiar with all the different forums.
Yep.
But a fella named Jude Donato. Kind of because he's from Roanoke or West Roanoke at the time, and my folks are from Roanoke, and I kind of got became friends with him. He encouraged me and badgered me until I would show it to the Mar. So I showed it to the Mar, and he kind of showed me around, and then it's his fault. Like I looked into the club.
He's your pusher.
Yeah, and there it's like I said, it's all history from there.
Very cool. Well, David, I want to thank you for joining us on the podcast today and giving us a little bit of your background and more importantly, tell us about MAR coming up because I know I missed that event. I guess this will help to encourage me to make sure I come back to MAR.
It was actually sort of our annual event for our little club here.
Yeah, it was.
We would all make the pilgrimage en masse to MAR.
Yeah.
We haven't done that in a few years. I think maybe we need to do that again.
Get a club gathering and go out.
Adam Stone used to come down, right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, he was part of the club. Yeah. Yeah. He moved. He's still in Ohio, and I think he still has his V6 series.
He keeps saying he needs to dig it out and start working on it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
He always impressed me. He had a sticker in the back window of his truck that said, this vehicle bought by selling Mary Kay Cosmetics.
Well, well, hold on.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
The
well,
sticker fairy, right?
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. See, well. The gentleman who is president of our club, Fort Pitt Land Rover Group, is Mark Love, and Mark Love is the one that came up with those stickers as a joke, and he owns a bazillion of them, and he paid way too much money for them. It was a joke. He said, "I need these stickers. I got this Land Rover selling Mary Kay," and somebody said, "Oh, sure, I'll make them for you."
Yeah, Mark didn't understand that when you get something like that done, it's going to cost, and there's going to be a minimum quantity on that stuff. He just figured,
right.
Hand me some stickers.
It'd be like $40, and I'll have a handful of stickers, and the joke's over. No, it was like 1,000 stickers, and $400 later.
I believe enough stickers remain, we could wrap an entire Rover twice over.
So if anytime you go to one of our events and you get a new truck, or if you scrape it off of your truck, by the time you leave, Mark will have put one back on to your truck.
Nice.
So
it's
yes,
it's a good gag. I like that. I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Yeah. Mark?
You know you're in the club when you've been tagged.
The Freelander, my Freelander had it. My Disco had it.
Well, your Freelander deserved it.
And my Series 3 got it. And I even had imported a Defender 110. It went to one event, and 10 minutes later, and I knew Mark was going to do this, so I was keeping an eye out. I don't know. He must have given the sticker to somebody else, but all of a sudden it was tagged. I was like, gee, thanks, Mark. So.
Nice.
Yeah. Yes, but yeah. So thanks for coming on and talking to us about MAR. Sounds like the event is back, and that's good. There's ebb and flow, as you said. I mean, our club even experiences the ebb and flow of activity and interest. So glad to hear MAR's still with us.
Yes, we've got lots of trails cut through the woods, and they're good trails. And I think that if you talk to the folks about last year, I think even your friend Jeff Aronson, I know you guys have spoke to him a few times. He comes down from MAR.
Yep.
The Rovers North team hosts the trials event, the run through the canes, and that's a ton of fun. And so it's we have a lot more capacity for a lot more folks, and it's and we're hoping for better weather this year because it can't get any worse than last year.
Careful. dude,
never tempt the Rover gods with something like that.
So, as Harold said, our club, you know, we go down every year, and I start taking video. And so that would be our club video for the year. What was this? 2005, I think. It rained like a mofo the whole event. And I took video and I made up the club video for the year. And then next year we're headed down. And on the drive down, Mark Love again, because we were all traveling together, he says, "Oh, this year's going to be fine. How can it be horrible 2 years in a row?" And thankfully I got that on tape, because exactly that same thing happened. We got to the event. It was bone dry. As soon as we got to the event, I think that was 06, the skies, you know, closed up, I suppose, and all the rain came down. It rained for like 3 days, and you couldn't even go on the trails. It was that
bad. Not just rain, but sideways water.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Maybe we'll do some podcast recording at MAR.
You're more than welcome. It's great. There's good Wi-Fi signal there too. If you're
is there?
So yeah.
Ooh, that could be. That's not as helpful.
On location.
I'd record stuff and do something later. But yeah, maybe we'll do something. Maybe you can help us out with that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again, David, for joining us on the show, and look forward to seeing you at MAR.
All right. Good deal. Thanks, guys.
As we close out the podcast, we learned in the last couple of weeks after the last podcast that a longstanding member of the Land Rover community in North America passed away by the name of Trevor Easton. He was a longtime member and contributor to the LRO list, which is Land Rover Owners List, had been around since the early days of the internet. And as I said, he was a longtime member. I think he was even may have started it, if I'm not mistaken, or at least one of the early originators of the LRO list. But he passed away, and he was, I guess, apparently in his 70th year. And he lived in southern Ontario, actually, I think near Hamilton, Ontario. So reading from his obituary, Trevor was a proud volunteer of the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum. He enjoyed sailing, and he was a past president of the Toronto Area Land Rover Club. And he also operated the locomotive at the Puddicombe Farms in Winona, Ontario. They had a celebration of his life took place today, actually, which is the 24th of April 2016, at the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum, which is in Hamilton, Ontario. And so that took place today. And so we just want to express our thoughts to his family and friends in the passing of Trevor.
And I will note that his Rover, Miss Golightly, also known as Miss G, as I always saw him sign on the mailing list, has been handed down to his grandson, who is interested in getting her running again. So nice to see the Rover rovering on.
It's nice to see it staying in the family, too.
Absolutely.
So that is the Center Steer podcast for the month of April 2016. This has been show number 37. I want to thank our contributors, Harold and Morgan, for joining us on the show today, in addition to our two guests, David Short, who was the treasurer of Rove, talking to us about MAR, and Graham and Louisa Bell, who are currently in Baja, Mexico, and they're having their kickstarting this week for their new book. So I hope you enjoyed today's show. I want to thank you for listening. Please visit our website for past shows and show notes, including all the information that we discussed today. Don't forget to connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Give us your feedback on the topics we covered today, and maybe even the audio quality. Hopefully we've taken care of the audio quality here. We do have listeners from around the world. In the past month, we've added a couple folks from Brazil and three from Venezuela. and not, in addition to our own Will Hendrick, and hopefully you're listening, Will, and you're invited to the show. We'd love to hear from you, even if it's just a picture of your Land Rover or the Land Rover you lust after, as Chip did this past month. Don't forget to visit 4x4radionetwork.com to listen to other shows that are part of the network. And you can listen right on the website if you want to any of the shows. Until our next show, I ask you to share the podcast with another fellow Land Rover owner. And thanks for listening. Wave as you pass by.
Sometimes. Yeah, you guys do run a little long sometimes.
A little bit sometimes, yes.